This is On the Other Hand. A podcast sponsored by Brave Angels in Arkansas that explores politics and other issues of importance to Arkansans through conversations with community leaders. Stay with us as we talk to another leader in Arkansas who works across differences to get things done and to bring us closer together.
Well, Glenn, we had a great conversation with Marquis Hunt in our previous episode, and now we'll continue with the second part of the conversation we had with him. And in this next episode, we're going to hear more about his experiences of bringing in right relationships within his own journey and intersecting the journey of others without requiring them to look like what we expect them to look like.
Yeah, and we also hear him talk about this notion of love anyway, which I think is really important to hear. And also he talks a little bit about self-honesty, being honest with yourself and the importance of that in being able to love and interact in the right way with others. I want to address something because you mentioned early on about some of the things that you did around the time of George Floyd and that going on. And I know that there's concerns about, given all the discrimination and mistreatment and bias that people experience, such as people of color like yourself or people of different sexual orientations or gender identities or, gosh, you know, geographical, ethnic, you name it. There's a natural, understandable tendency to respond, at least in one way, with anger and hate and negative emotions when you experience that. How then, if we're going to advocate for love and a peaceful approach, how do we get people to work in ways toward positive goals that both address those discriminations and those difficult moments that other people impose on others, while also advocating and staying consistent with an overall response that's characterized by love and peace?
Well, now you talk about a complex question. It's okay. Often, we have two choices. We can choose to love, we can choose to hate. If we must choose hate, I urge, choose to hate that which is not love. So that gives us opportunity to use hate and to turn it into something that is productive. And so often we use the word terms like positive and negative. I like to see the word, I see the word negative kind of like in photography, the negative image. It's in the negative space is where you get to experience new possibilities. It's not just a bad thing. So I wouldn't necessarily contrast anger with love, because I think anger also is a useful emotion. In our sacred scriptures, when I was growing up, there was one that said, be angry, but sin not, or be angry, but do not misunderstand, is what a good translation would be. Do not misunderstand the anger. And so if the choice is to love, people injure, if you take issues like discrimination or xenophobia, homophobia, the reason those things exist is because someone somewhere is rehearsing or practicing the antithesis of what love is. Discrimination does not emerge from a healthy mind, not racist discrimination. Obviously, you want to discriminate against a poisonous berry and a healthy berry. So again, there is discrimination happening. What we want to avoid is when people are discriminating against something in ignorance or stupidity. Charging that black is bad, or essentially engineering a meme or an idea that black is bad, or that gay is bad, or that transgenderism is bad. And what we have to be clear to do, and I don't think, not necessarily dogmatically, we have to be aggressive and firm about stating what is and what is not true and understanding what that is. And so as a person who I have to essentially censor almost every room I walk in as a black man, I often find myself in spaces where I am the only black person there. What white people may never know is I'm constantly censoring and adjusting and recalibrating in those moments because of how I have experienced the hegemony and how I have been reacted to. And then sometimes when I've tried to make adjustments, what those responses are. So I think love demands or asks that we respond effectively to what's really happening and not just really to the jargon of what's happening. And so it's a sensitive thing, especially in the political climate, because we have the tendency to take hostage the culture, to take hostage the money, to take hostage the property, to take hostage the legislature, to take hostage the congressional districts in a way that does not represent a democratic value or voting or majority. In those moments, how would we treat a hostage taker? Would we acknowledge that hostage taker as legitimately operating in a value that's honorable? Or would we move to create comfort, not just for the hostage taker, but for the victims who are being held hostage? And so I think the response of love is first to ameliorate and to mollify and to find ways to remove the cancer or to neutralize the diabetes, if you would, or to find ways to undermine the ailment in a way that more productivity can happen. And sometimes those answers are abstract. They take time or they take insight, but they certainly never do take lazy.
Yeah.
You know, working with other people to do that kind of work, to ameliorate the hate, and to respond to what's really happening, not just the jargon of what we were, you know, hearing is happening. That requires a lot of humility. You talked about the humility of learning. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit more. There was a statement you made earlier on when you were talking about jazz, about that in jazz, we have to learn how to accept differences without disagreements. And I'm not quite sure what that looks like when we're dealing with folks who are different than us, and wondered if you could maybe give us an illustration or an example of that.
Oh, wow. Now, this is an even harder question, April. difference without disagreement. Okay, because I remain true to the thesis that we are all different. In my book, I explore a conversation on boundaries. And in that conversation, I talk about being in right relationship. And oftentimes people, and you probably know this in your profession, Glenn, particularly that, because there's now, and there's a, I think, a popular almost therapy or practice or suggestion that's like, you need to practice healthy boundaries. Practice healthy boundaries. I personally think that the legitimate boundaries are the ones that can't be negotiated, like gravity. You know, it's going to be what it is, regardless of what you call it. So what I say is, the matter is learning to be in right relationship with it. So let's say water, for instance, is different than fire, or water is a way, because of water inside of the house, you can get mold and you could damage your roof, damage your carpet, damage your wood. So we build a roof to keep the water out and to keep ourselves dry, but we don't want to keep the water out of the house. So we construct a mechanism through which we can get water into the house safely so that we can use it and be in right relationship with it. Another way of being in right relationship is the way we process food and digest it. We eat. Eating the food is one relationship with the food. Digesting the food is another relationship with the food. Expelling the food or defecating the food is another relationship with the same thing. So we have this one thing that changes its form. And what happens, I think, when we have difference and disagreement is because we personally hold hostage the initial experience of eating. It's good. The food tastes good. And these sometimes are our memories in relationship. We have a great memory, a great start. But there is no moment that lasts as the moment forever. Even in relationship, even in society, we begin to process change digestively, even in relationship, where we learn to keep things in and it turns into nutrients. And some things, after they are distilled or sieved, they turn into toxicity. But our bodies are created to handle the toxicity. So we have to first realize that we have the capacity to handle toxicity. If we build and nurture the apparatus that's designed in our humanity to field it. And then another thing that happens when we get to the disagreement, especially when the disagreements become profound and we become dysfunctional, it's like we perseverate over the defecation. It's like going to the bathroom and then just keep looking at whatever you produce as though you can't flush it. But it can turn into nitrogen. It can turn into fertilizer. It can turn into a tomato. And you can eat it. It just takes time. But it also takes an awareness and an understanding, so I don't have to be angry at my digestion. I don't have to misunderstand my digestion or my difference. I have to be in right relationship with it and allow it to breathe in a way that doesn't allow it to disrupt the unit. And this is, I think, where we find the problems in society. We are still learning to protect the individual and not necessarily protect or honor the human event, and then see how the human event is still happening to the world. We are happening to this world. We are happening to this earth collectively. But some of us believe that we are only happening as an individual. And that is a part of my critiques on the culture. We're not just happening alone. We're happening all at the same time together.
So you're talking a lot in metaphors, and I love that, the water, the food. So I'm thinking about maybe a time in which you were able to bridge those differences with an actual person. And your relationship was, you were working on being in right relationship with them. What did that look like? How do we do that?
Well, as a man, a cisgendered or heterosexual man, I don't know that I'm heteronormative, but I'm certainly heterosexual as such. I remember coming to an awareness as a father and as a husband and as a son and as a brother and as a friend. And I realized something, and I got in trouble in some of my mainstay relationships because I was changing and it wasn't comfortable for everyone around me. So I remember making a statement as I was introducing myself in an activist circle. They said, "Tell us something about yourself." And I said, "Well, my name is Marquis and I'm a husband and sometimes I'm not. I'm a father and sometimes I'm not. I'm a son and sometimes I'm not. I'm a brother and sometimes I'm not." To kind of create this, here's another metaphor, but when I begin to take this into the real personal thing, I realized that I was requiring people at that time, my kid's mom, to be a wife and a wife only. I wasn't honest with myself that I met a person on a journey and that I intersected the journey, but I didn't create or engineer the person, and that person was full of several roles that were developing in her life. But the culture told me that I had to hold her hostage to a certain idea. And then when the tension rose, when I was expecting a wife, it could have been vice versa, that I was calling for something that I was not in right relationship with her humanity. because I was trying to make my preference more important than her life statement, her life mission, or the reason she's in the world, not just for me, but for everyone who is affected by her breath. And so this was, when I begin to realize this, I'm like, okay, I can be in right relationship with her. I won't call her name. I could be in right relationship with her without needing, because right now being a husband or being my wife is not the right relationship. This is not what needs to emerge. She needs to be a medical assistant or a medical administrator. There are people who need her expertise or insight, and I don't need to be ruminating over what I'm missing, because I'm not really missing in this moment. So I began to navigate almost every relationship I had to not compel it or pressure it to match my preference. It was in that moment I began to realize that there was enough God, enough everything for the whatever moment I was in to present what was necessary. My only task then was to find where contentment was and then breathe and listen better.
You know, there are two words that you've used a number of times in the past that I think are pretty powerful, and I think they may apply there, but also to some of the other things we've talked about. So I want you to just kind of tell me a little bit about what this means to you and what it may suggest about what other people do in a concrete way. And those two words are love anyway.
Well, if you've loved once, I say you've experienced a miracle. If you've loved more than once, you know that loving once pales in comparison. And when you simply learn to love, then you know to stop counting. Over almost three decades ago, I was in a moment and I experienced, in a particular moment, I was, I think, alone. None of the traditional things were, I think, right around me at the moment. But I was overwhelmed with this awareness that my capacity to love was without limit. And then I immediately became challenged to not believe that. I believed that there was a limit to how much I could love. And then, so the statement goes, your capacity to love is limitless. And when you're challenged to not believe this, love anyway. So it was a pressure, a push to recognize that. I began to ask myself several investigative questions. Some of them were rhetorical. Is there a moment in my life that I don't want to experience love? And the answer was unequivocally no. And I said to myself, is there a moment in my life that I want to have more of a love value than the other? And my answer then was unequivocally no. And so then I began to wonder, if someone is required, if I'm required to love someone and I choose against loving them, are they obligated to be without love because of my stupidity? The answer then was unequivocally no. So then I began to realize that love would emerge because love was responsible to demonstrate itself in any moment. And my charge was to learn how to solve for love. So this has become my mission, is to try to find moment. And trust me, I am constantly challenged to choose against love. But I think in doing so, I would choose against myself because I would injure. There's no way to choose against love without causing injury. There's just no way to do it. And so when I think about society and even the people who hate me because of my skin color, some of those things I think are a necessary consequence, or it is an effect of the injuries that so many people have experienced in ways that we don't even know that it's happening. the desire to take power, to dominate someone else in an effort to feel alive. Whenever we think hurting someone else, whenever our amygdala tells us that in order for me to survive, I must hurt this person, then I'm obligated to do it unless I can rethink. And so that's the space that we have to negotiate, is if I were on the other end and I am the enemy of someone's survival, do I want them to rethink who I am? And I certainly do.
Very good. So do you have any, maybe some specific recommendations for, you know, in Braver Angels, where April and I are both active in that, as you know, we try to promote civility in a conversation with people who are different in their political leanings. But at some point, we want to get down to some really concrete actions that we can take in with ourselves, with our with others, and in the community. So what kind of actions would you recommend that could help us make a difference in our communities, whether it be us in Braver Angels or someone listening, or just, you know, what are specific things that can help us move toward that greater sense of love and loving anyway, even when sometimes your instinct and your amygdala says do otherwise?
Well, I think it's important that we, one, live through personal honesty, knowing that there's a part of our breeding that has almost demanded that we consider certain people as enemies to us, as an act of survival. Part of that thinking is engineered. It's designed. And any of us doing this work, I think that's one truth that we have to be honest about. It's designed, and some people are caught in the trap of it, and some people are caught in the loop of it, unaware. They're, as what they say, they're an unwilling co-conspirator. And it's important for those of us who are initiated or learn to recognize when we are dealing with an uninitiated co-conspirator and when we are dealing with a designer and the perpetrator. And fairness demands that we don't treat them all the same. I'm okay with a person being a liar as long as I know they're a liar. I don't even need them to tell the truth, because at least I know what they're saying ain't the truth. You know, I get some advantage with that alone. But I don't need them to be different, but I do want to be in right relationship with the liar, and I want the people I love and the people I'm with to be in right relationship with the lie. I don't think the lie ever has a side. The lie does not have a side. It is not a part of what's real. It is aimed solely at dismantling, discrediting, and destroying what is real. And so I think anybody invested in the real, whatever part of the spectrum they're in, they're charged with honoring this and protecting the unit against that type of deception. Any of us doing this work, whether it's in ministry or in public education or in private education, when we are molding minds, I think part of what our responsibility is not just to offer information, but it's also to build a skill and a muscle to understand how to handle information. The words are never what the truth is. They're just guideposts or symbols aimed at helping us learn something. So what I tell my clients is never expect people to tell you the truth. Expect them to tell you something that tells you more about who they are.
So how do we build those skills and that skill set on how to handle information?
Well, I start with personal honesty. Our emotions help us, you know, learn. One, we can reside with I'm comfortable, I'm uncomfortable before we have an action. I think the healthy person responds more than reacts. So part of what we do, one of the things I do, as I start people down this process, I encourage them to take a notepad put a line down in the middle of it, and on one column say I believe, on the other column say I know. And then I ask them to, throughout the day, start a practice of listening to themselves say I believe, and then what comes after that, and then listen to themselves say I know, and then what comes after that, and then investigate whether these things are actually true. And people oftentimes conflate or mistake what they believe with what they know, and they begin to make decisions on what they believe, thinking they're making decisions about what they know. So those are the assumptions. It's okay to believe. I mean, believe what you want, but at least be honest about the fact that you believe it and you don't know it. That's perfectly healthy. So that's why I encourage people to start. And if people can begin to master personal honesty, it will naturally bleed into the way we are with each other in relationship and in conversation and in communion.
You brought up at the beginning, and I want to tie this back in as we kind of get to the place where we're going to tie things up here in a bit, that kind of a summary of what you do is you breathe and you listen as you're observing humanity. And I'd love to hear a little bit more about that. The breathing and the listening in that process of learning to handle information and being honest.
Well, I had a mentor years ago who was a psychologist. We would travel across the country doing seminars in ministry. And she was telling me a story, kind of in a generic story, about some work she had to do with a minister or a daughter who was being abused by a father who was a minister. And this is one of the first times in my life I was like this close to realizing, oh my God, how do you manage to hear that information? Like that felt very real. It felt viscerally real to me. And I said, it must take an awful amount of skill to just kind of be in the space where you have trauma happening and you have betrayal happening and dishonesty happening. And I began to discover then that people aren't always telling me the truth, even though they may think they are. There's something being said when there's always something being said that you're not hearing. Music kind of taught me this, to breathe and to listen for the chord, the music. Like, oh, I know this is a C major chord, but it feels like a blues chord in A minor, and how I'm trying to reconcile the two. And so part of that's a joke. I do breathe because I play saxophone. But then when I'm with people, and oftentimes I'm hearing a conversation happen with one relating partner and another conversation happening with another relating partner. And what I realize more than anything is they're missing each other in terms of what they are experiencing and even how the words even mean to them. And what do you do when the words don't mean the same thing? And you're not aware that you're not even communicating, but you think you are. And so I listen. I listen for the moment. I wait. I do my best to wait for that moment, and especially music, to hit not just any note, but to hit the note that triggers, the note that pierces, the note that penetrates, and the note or scale or rhythm that transforms. And in every relationship I have, and I bring this back to me, I'm interested in being transformed as a result of it. I expect if it's healthy, I will change into where I would discover a part of me that I didn't know existed. And I can learn that even with those who antagonize me and those who seek to do me harm. I can listen, I can observe, I can breathe, or in my religious tradition, it would have been it would be watch and pray.
You know, one thing about the breathing part reminds me, that breathing and listening. Listening, of course, is a key point about what Braver Angels does, is to listen before you talk. Really listen sincerely. So that's easy. When I hear the breathing part, other than the saxophone playing, I don't do that, but the breathing part is really important. It's an essential element of life and of emotional regulation, because when one breathes slowly and calmly and deeply, that is the way the body normally functions when it's calm and at peace and the amygdala is not involved. When you start getting angry or fearful, then you get emotional and the amygdala kicks in and the whole body changes. And one of the things it does is breathe fast, rapid, you know, shallow. And so in my role as formerly as a psychologist, that was one of the key, you know, stress management techniques, is the breathing exercise. And so I can see how that's, however meant way you meant it, that is another way I think it fits really well with the kinds of things we're wanting to do. Breathe, relax, listen, and it makes things go better overall, I'd say.
Oh, absolutely. There have been so many things here that you've brought out, Marquis, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. And just curious, I think you have a band. Where can people hear you play?
Ooh, I don't even know the answer to that question right now. I don't have any more calendar dates. They can hear me in Orlando in December. they could catch me on any streaming platform. Marquis Hunt, Marquis, last name Hunt, or Google Marquis Hunt, saxophonist, and they can pull up some files somewhere and listen to me if they can't get me in person. Or they could just call me and book me, or the band, and I'll come wherever they are. Wherever you are, April, I'll come. Just, when's your party? When's the next party?
Okay, well, I got to get my party set up then.
And the name of your band is?
Marquis and Mood.
Who else? I'm just curious in terms of the other kind of music instruments, representations. Who do you have besides saxophone?
Well, I have piano or keys, bass guitar, electric guitar, rhythm, drums, and vocals.
And it sounds great. Believe me, I've heard it many a time. It's great stuff.
Well, this has been wonderful.
Yeah.
Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners, Marquis? I mean, we could have taken this in a variety of different directions, but I love what you've shared and the connection with the metaphor of humanity and our humanity being a human event, and we're always adding to it, but also opening up chords so we can look at them more closely, all the music metaphors that you've used. But is there anything else you'd like to share with us?
Well, thank you both for having me on the other hand, and I think our hands work well together, and we don't want to be our hands fighting. But thank you for having me on the other hand. And what I'll say is this: be kind to yourself first and last, and everybody else in between.
Right on. That sounds great. Thank you so much, Marquis. Really enjoyed talking with you.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, we hope you enjoyed the second part of today's discussion with Marquis Hunt. Be sure to check out the first part of this two-part conversation we had with him, as well as other podcast episodes of this podcast, on the other hand. And you can find those on the Braver Angels Arkansas website at arkansas.braverangels.org or on many popular podcast sites.
And when you visit our website, in addition to links to all our other episodes, you'll find a link to email us at otherhandar@gmail.com. That's otherhandar@gmail.com. We encourage you to use that email to let us know feedback about the program, and we'd love to hear your ideas about other speakers.
On the Other Hand is sponsored by Braver Angels in Arkansas. Music was composed by Randall Standridge of Jonesboro, Arkansas, and was performed by the University of Northern Colorado Symphonic Band, Dr. Richard Main, conductor.
From your host, Glenn White,
and April Chatham Carpenter.
Let's each do our part to bring our community closer together.